All right, careful with that chair. Sorry, it's it has a tendency to if you lean too far forward. Sorry, I do warn you about that.
It's okay. So far, so good.
So today is May 12th, 2015. This is the third interview with Linda Newman. We are in my office inside Steambach Memorial Library, and my name is Troy Reeves with the UW Mass and Archives. Linda, as we've done in the past, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, Linda Newman. And Newman is spelled N-E-W-M-A-N.
All right. Okay, so I sent you a list of questions yesterday. We just briefly chatted about how you felt about them. Seems like you feel fine about them, so we'll start numerically and somewhat chronologically. So the first question on the list was what comments you might have on your father's involvement in the Spanish Civil War.
Thank you. That was huge in my life. When I was younger, my parents' political commitments, having been communists at a certain point in time, weighed on me. I think I'm a somewhat socially conservative person. Now, in my later years, I'm extraordinarily proud of them. And my parents had the Songs of the Lincoln Brigade. Music, as I look back on it, and particularly left music, although I thought of it as the music, played a huge part in my growing up. So Paul Robeson's voice is just totally a part of me, and he has a song he did called Ballad for Americans, starting out in 76, The Sky Was Red. And I could go on, but I don't need to. And I learned the songs of the Spanish Civil War, and I learned, unconsciously, I suppose I could say, tremendous pride in the Republican cause in Spain. And after Franco died, and Franco was a looming enemy that I was aware of, the other looming enemy growing up was the fat man, because the Daily Worker, to which my parents subscribed, characterized capitalism as the fat man, which I have to say gets more and more apropos the older I get as I look at it. After Franco died, my mother and brother were able to go to Spain. And as my mother said, it filled the hole that had been in her heart since probably 1936. And her becoming a radical when she was studying with Curdy at Smith and learned about the Scottsboro Boys, took her to New York City to work for the taxi union where my dad was working after returning from Spain. So it's very much, and she met him in the context of a taxi strike in New York City. So that whole politics, and then later when I worked in the history department and became very fond of Stan Payne. When I was working as the undergrad advisor, I got to know the chairs of the department more than I did other faculty just because of administrative responsibilities. And Stan Payne is by no means a leftist. It has been enlightening my whole life to recognize how focused and one-sided my parents' views of things were, because I just assumed that, you know, and I'm exaggerating, everybody's dad fought in the Spanish Civil War, and everybody loved the Dodgers when they were in Brooklyn. So the Spanish Civil War is, I suppose, just a part of my childhood. Just like learning pretty young that my mother's ancestors came over on the Mayflower. So it was a fascinating household. And one of the blessings of this part of my life is how close my brother and I are getting, so that lots of memories come up between us. That was not so much the case growing up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So the next question sort of somewhat follows on that. Growing up as you did with the parents that you had, did you know anything about Madison's sort of left-leaning community in the 60s when you came here?
Very much so. My aunt, I often lay all of my sanity And my current partnership also to my father's sister, Miriam, my Aunt Miriam, who first lived in Brooklyn and I visited there, and then in Manhattan, and I just flat out adored her. And she had a nephew on the other side of her family with whom I hung out when I was in high school. No, it was when I was in college. Some. And he was all full of UW-Madison talk and all full of, from his perspective, and I didn't particularly think of him as any kind of expert, but that's where I needed to go to school, given my background, because my father was nothing if not boisterous about his views about everything. And then, as I think I said before, our friends that Christmas before, probably when I was a senior in college, had gotten William Appleman Williams' book for Christmas, and I had looked into that, and I think Williams, I think this is slightly naive, but I think he was politically involved for sure, and I think, just trying to think, which piece of things, and he may have been somebody who was, Williams may have been somebody kind of stimulated by McCarthy to be more a civil libertarian kind of person. I don't think he was a leftist by any stretch, but I think he was perceived that way a little bit when you looked at what the spectrum was from right to left at that point in the department.
I'm embarrassed to admit I don't know this for sure, but so I'm going to ask. So when you started working for the history department in early 78, right, was William still there, or had he moved to Oregon by
no,
then?
No, I think he was in Oregon by then. Okay. In fact, I'm virtually certain he was in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we talked a little bit about your involvement in the protests, the Vietnam era protests, the stuff that happened on campus, but I'm curious as to whether or not you became involved in other political or social activist movements sort of outside of campus, particularly in the 60s and 70s.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, somewhere along the line, I became a pretty ardent feminist. So I was doing consciousness raising, and I was doing that with, at the same time that I was driving cab for Union Cab. So that was between being a grad student and coming to work at the university. But the circle of women with whom I met were graduate students in women's studies. I hadn't thought about this at all lately. And one of the jokes, I don't know if we can, well, I guess I can say it, do what we want with it, is that none of us knew how to roll our own joints. We were feminists, but we always had our boyfriends roll the joints. And I'm not remembering the last names of those women, but they went on to be successful. And I had been parenthetically trying to remember for you Scott and Joan, who were a couple, and they eventually split up. And Joan, and I cannot get her last name, became a very renowned historian. I think he did as well. And one of them might have been working with Goldberg, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
But then there was this Nancy person, and not remembering who the other women were in that circle. So I was involved with that, which was on and off campus. And when I was at Checker Cab, and I think I've said this before, I helped to create Union Cab. So that was a situation of going out on strike at Checker and getting involved with trying to think what union that was. We affiliated with a union where it wasn't altogether logical. It definitely wasn't the Teamsters. But they were very, very helpful. And eventually, Checker folded. And I was driving for Union when I came and got the job as the history advisor, I'm pretty sure. And then I drove for them during the summer until my appointment became a 12-month appointment.
Okay. So I want to come back to the political activism stuff, but since you talked about driving cab, was that primarily happened between the when you decided not to get the PhD and then getting the job in the history department?
Yes, because what I remember is that I drove 76. We created a red, white, and blue taxi and called it 76 because it was 76. So that must have been before I started at the history department as an undergrad advisor. But somewhere in there, I worked as an LTE in the Marine Studies Center based on my involvement with the creation of the Institute for Environmental Studies. Mm-hmm. So
to come back to your social or political activism, were you involved at all in the Gay Liberation Front, Madison's?
Oh. Yes. Let's see. Steinhardt. John and Carol Steinhardt became sort of the core of what we called ourselves a commune. And we lived together for 2 years, one year across the lake and 1 year in the highlands. And my then husband, who was a PhD student of Jensen's, and he finished and works with the national publication, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, he was involved with IES and all of that, but he also was gay. And came out at that time, and then he became very close friends with the members of a gay household. They lived on East Johnson, and one of them was a grad student in history, and one of them was a grad student in American Studies, maybe. Or no, I think the other one was getting his degree in urban planning. And through them, Dale Hillerman was one of them, Chuck Thoreau, the other, and Dale's passed. But Dale was involved with the Gay Center that was at that point upstairs from Oriental Specialties, which was on State Street. And I had no inkling at that time that I was gay, am gay, whatever, however one parses all of that. I don't particularly. But Dale was going out to talk somewhere. But the lesbian didn't show up, so I went and passed, except it turned out I wasn't passing, but I didn't know that. And I've had occasion to remember they do lots of posters for the festivals on Willie Street, and I spend a great deal of time at Katie's American Indian Arts, and they have the poster for maybe the Fête de Marquette, I think it is, which is the Monet painting with the naked men and the dress-clothed men and the naked women. For the Fête de Marquette, everybody's got their clothes on. But then when we did a gay picnic, when I still was aggressively affirming that I was straight, we did an opposite poster where I was in the poster as the woman, fully clothed, and two gay men were naked sitting around me. And when John Tortorisi discovered that when he was doing some kind of gay history event, he was highly entertained. Didn't know that it was all that funny, but funny's not the right word. That's not fair to John. So yes, again, somewhat inadvertently, like the Spanish Civil War, it came up in my family because the man to whom I was then married, Ken Bowling, is a very, 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 very close friend of mine, and we have a son. And we are now, just incidentally, on our way the 1st of June to go visit with Dick and Lynn Cohn. And Dick's a very, very renowned historian who retired from Chapel Hill, UNC, and his wife and he have always had a place up north in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So that's just been fun.
Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure, even though the recorder obviously would pick it up, I want to make sure I heard you right. So your husband, was it your husband who came out
mm-hmm.
while you were married?
Yes.
Did you have an inkling that he was going to do that?
Let's see. How would I say this? That was also a time of, how do I want to say? I've done recovery from everything except caffeine, which I will not be giving up. So we were in a space of less clear lines of relationships that I think was somewhat the case at that time. So by the time he came out, it didn't have much to do with me. We lived in a commune together. Our son was in it. The Steinhardt's kids were in it. Other people were in it. So I can't say that I didn't know. It was more, I think, through the friendship with Chuck and Dale, and there was a third man living in that collective, David Bryant, who's passed, and also Ron Labraska. Let's see. Yeah, I'm mixing him up. Labraska was, he was straight. Let me get that clear. I'm thinking of somebody. It's Ron McRae, who was in that gay collective. Labraska was a man who's also passed, and he was involved with the whatever the strike version of the State Journal was. Mm-hmm. But that's another story.
The press connection.
The press connection. And the press connection and Union Cab used to do benefits together at the Cardinal. Mm-hmm. So that's where the knitting together. And the Cardinal then belonged to Ricardo Gonzalez? I don't think so, but maybe. Mm-hmm. And Ricardo was huge in gay Madison. So I think by the time Ken came out, we were all, one of the ways I've talked about it is we were all gay men. I obviously am not a gay man, but the familial connection, which is really what it is. I mean, Chuck Thoreau is one of my best friends in the universe right now. And we're in the three-week phase where we're the same age, and then I get older. But part of what holds us together are all the dead people we're carrying, whom we love incredibly, and certainly some of them of AIDS, and some from natural causes. You know, you're getting to be in your 70s, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was involved in gay liberation. I hadn't thought of it so much that way, because I was very much in the feminist side, and I also worked with, now that I think of this, a feminist newspaper whose name I'm not going to remember. And a lot of the women working on that with me were openly gay. And there was a wonderful occasion where this one lesbian who was working with me on the newspaper wanted to know if I was miserable. I said, no, I wasn't miserable. Well, she couldn't be my friend. Which I think is just sort of a classic commentary on that particular point in time. Because one should be miserable. Not necessarily.
Thank you for all that.
You're welcome.
You mentioned earlier, I'm going to take us in a different direction here. You mentioned earlier you knew the music of the Lincoln Brigade.
Right.
And as a person who's become interested, you know, I wasn't of the 60s and 70s,
right,
but a lot of the music I listened to is of the 60s and 70s.
Right.
So I'm wondering what role the music of that era has for you.
It's huge, and I was really, really glad for the question. And then, of course, I went into it's what I loved then, the right stuff. But then, falling asleep last night, I got Creedence Clearwater Revival and Proud Mary. My second husband, and I can't quite figure out where he fits into all this, I met him at Checker when I started to work at Checker Cab, and we're divorced. And not friends, but he was a Vietnam veteran. So I associate Proud Mary very much with the war. And I listened, the point in my life where I listened the most to the music. I mean, I loved the Beatles. My brother and I went to see Joan Baez when she was playing in Connecticut. And my mother gave me her ticket. And Bob Dylan appeared in the middle of the concert, and my mother was always regretful that she'd given me her ticket. And my brother and I were the only ones in the audience. This was a little open-air theater outside New Haven who knew the words to We Shall Overcome and sang along. So dates that one. And Ken Bowling and I went to see the Beatles in Milwaukee, which would have been right after we were married, so probably the fall of 63. I listened to the Moody Blues and loved them. I went to see Grace Slick and the Jefferson Airplane. I went to see Janis Joplin. Judy Collins, of course. So I loved concerts. There was a local band called The Oz, and I would listen to them. Trying to think who else. The Stones. Oh, my gosh, yes. And Steinhardt was doing a lot with multiple tracks of music, which was brand new, and the introductory courses in IES. So we all thought that was infinitely cool. So who are the bands that you like from the 60s and 70s?
Well, all of those you mentioned.
Okay.
I also, 70s, get into Stevie Wonder.
Okay.
Let's see, now you're throwing this question back on me. And
that's okay. I'll take it back. I'll take it back.
No, it's... Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, With or Without.
That was huge. I mean, absolutely huge with us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we lived the music all the time. It's one of the reasons I'm really enjoying the question, because I haven't gotten back to that yet. I've got headphones, I just haven't gotten used to using them. Another one that was huge even then was Leonard Cohen, because I remember I had a huge fight with Chuck about whether or not Leonard Cohen could sing. And my current partner, whom I've been with for over 20 years, just over 20 years, can't abide Dylan. And as a side note, Bob Dylan and I are twins. So in addition to being Geminis, we were born the same day, the same year. And my ex-husband, with whom I'm friends, just corrected a friend who said, Dylan's going to be 73. He said, nope, he's going to be 74, just like my ex-wife.
Others would be, for me anyway, would be Simon Garfunkel, James Taylor.
Yes, yes.
Carole King.
Yes. And there was a gay bar at the corner of Regent and Park. And at one point or another in my life, I was hanging out with the gay family, but dating a guy named Roger, and Roger and I would go dancing. I can't think of the name of the bar, but it was all Tapestry. No, it wasn't Tapestry. It was You're So Vain. That was just an anthem at the time. And Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Oh, my gosh, yes. And then Neil Young also, kind of a little heavier. But wonderful music.
Mm. Well, if any others jump out at you while we're continuing this, don't hesitate just to throw
random great music at you.
Random great music at me, yes.
Yeah.
So the first couple of times, I don't remember whether it was the first or second session or maybe a bit of both, you talked about George Mossy.
Oh, yes.
And so Mossy's sort of counterpoint during this time period is Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if you have stories or memories of Goldberg.
Oh, my God, yes, and thank you for asking. Harvey and I didn't make friends until just before he died. And I was friends with the woman whose last name I can't remember, who had been Harvey's student, I think this is the way it went, and fell in love with Meisner. Or maybe she was Meisner's student, fell in love with Meisner, became Harvey's student. And Harvey and I, just as I remember it, just hung out. And I'm pretty sure I went to see him when he was in the hospital. And I remember we talked a lot about if he was ready to retire, because he hadn't really put that through until he knew he was dying. And I just loved him. I just loved him. But I didn't know him when, you know, everybody was filling up the halls with being his students so much. And I was aware of him when I was the undergrad advisor in terms of whether he got good TAs or he didn't get good TAs, all of that sort of thing. But interpersonally, it was very much close to the end. And I don't know if I would have told you when we talked about Gerda how kind she was to my mom and how much fun they had talking politics together before my mom died. And George was wonderfully kind to both my parents. George, along with Stephen Floral, Stern and Malin. Stern and Malin are friends now. But when I was in the department, George was really and truly just a wonderful, wonderful friend. And some of my undergrads were his students and went on. Andy Bachman went on to become a rabbi, and I think did George's funeral. And he was one of my very close students. And then a woman named Rachel Sabbath went on and became a rabbi. And when Andy was a rabbi and Rachel was a rabbi, Andy was a little skeptical of Rachel's ministering only to wealthy congregations. As he put it, I didn't double-check. I didn't check his, you know, his data. And George, as I may have mentioned, gave wonderful, wonderful Christmas parties. So they were just the best food, and everybody was there. And George was very, very devoted to both Stan Payne and his wife, Julie. So they would be there, and lots of other people from the department. And I was with my partner when George was still alive, and we did a couple of things with George and John. George was just amazing. I mean, this has been so much fun just making all those historians alive again, mm-hmm. but especially George. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you mentioned, if you did, I don't remember, in either of the previous interviews, Gerda Lerner.
Okay.
Who I think you just referenced. Just, right. So I wonder if you would talk a little bit about her.
Well, she arrived like nothing else ever. And I was close enough to Linda Gordon and Judy Leavitt and some of the women's history people because I, as a feminist, I felt like I sort of belonged even though I wasn't a scholar. So they had mixed feelings. She'd gone back to get her degree later. She's a very powerful presence. When we were, history had been in the humanities building for a long time. So I remember standing in the corridor. There was the office where the classified staff worked, and off that, a room with machines and so forth. And Gerda walked in and handed me a pile of papers and said, "Xerox these." I'd never seen her before in my life, and I thought, well, by location, I must be a clerical person. Another time, I was putting something in her office, and she discovered me in her office and just took my head off for invading her property. It was fine. It's okay. And I grew to love her very much. She would give a Christmas party for the Jews, and one of my, complexities, one could say, my dad was Jewish, my mother wasn't. As I tell the story now, I never was, but I passed. I didn't see it that way at the time because my father was so anti-Christian. But there were perks, too, and I'm not exactly proud of it, but I don't think that's the right way to think of it. So I would get to go to the Christmas party for the Jews at Gerda's for a while. And one of my partner's favorite stories, Steve and Flora would include us at the Seder's sometimes. And Florentius has said to me upon occasion, "You know, it was harder for you to come out to me as a Christian than it was as a lesbian." I said, I know. But Gerda was there, my partner, who's not Jewish, and Gerda asked her how they had done Seder's at her house when she was growing up. And I don't think Gerda ever noticed that she wasn't Jewish. That was Gerda. But she had me and my mom over when she was still living on Hammersley, and my mom having been a communist, and Gerda and Carl having been in New York and then Hollywood. And Gerda loved telling the stories, but also finding the overlap with my mom. And Gerda and George had so much in common. And then because I had been at dinner at Steve and Floral's, when Gerda was talking about doing a race wisdom workshop for the Dean of Students Office, I got invited to listen to that, and that was very powerful. And one of the things she taught us was you can't teach anybody anything by yelling at them, which I have taken very much to heart. My father was great for yelling at you to explain what was true in the world. But there were also me and another woman at that training, education, whatever, who knew ourselves to be gay, never said a word about it, and a couple of the straight women there explained to all of us they knew what it was like to be a lesbian. So I thought, well, no, you don't, but I don't feel comfortable enlightening you, which is evidence to me that you don't know, but that's okay, because you're straight. But like, not exactly like, but being betwixt and between Judaism and Christianity from heritage, and that's partly my partner teaching me that I don't have to choose. And of course, she's not a person of faith. So yes, of course I have chosen, but it doesn't mean I'm not Jewish, if that makes sense. And one of the wonderful moments for me was when George had written what he wanted. How did this work? No, it was what Gerda wrote to say about George when we did a memorial at the Union, at Memorial Union. She wasn't in town, and she told me to read it for her, which I took as a huge, huge tribute. And George did that biography, memoir, kind of, later in life. And the comments that I made on Gerda's behalf, George said that he had been talked out of entitling his book Curious George. But that's what he had wanted, and it would have been accurate. She was a force to be reckoned with, Gerda Lerner.
So, Mossy Goldberg, Gerda Lerner, any other professors from that time period, 60s, 70s?
Well, Williams, but he was early in that period. Michael McDonald. I don't know that I said to you, I had what I called the baby caucus, because the department was divided into caucuses, and Ken Sachs and Michael McDonald. And I can't remember if Steve Stern or Chuck Cohen, and Chuck Cohen also. I mean, Chuck Cohen is a very dear friend now. And Stan Cutler, I was just out to dinner with Chuck and his wife, and Stan Cutler was chair of the search committee that brought Cohen, which is a fact I didn't pick up on. It was right when I was working in the department. Oh, and John Dower, I would say in some ways, and Steve Fireman, were both very good friends while I was working in the department. And I sat in on Steve Fireman's History of East Africa course. And I thought, and still think, John Dower, historian of Japan, was the finest, probably the finest historian I ever met, and got very, very interested in graphic work, video work, and worked with a beautifully illustrated book about the aftermath of the bomb. And I think met the author and did film work, and then went on to teach at MIT.
Why was it called the Baby Caucus?
Oh, that's what I called them, because they were new assistant professors after I became. I've always had a somewhat of a mother hen response to people who are 10 and a half minutes younger than I am. So I just adopted them. Michael, Ken. I'm not sure who was the third one. But
so those are all folks who came in when you were working there, so 78 to 86.
Right. And I started with Peter Smith. And Suzanne Desan came in then, and I'm crazy about her, but she was not in the Baby Caucus. And I was crazy about Sella. I mean, I loved a lot of them. Domenico Sella was utterly remarkable. And such good citizens of the university. And I was, when Stan Cutler just passed, I was devastated. I didn't quite realize that he was so important to me, but he was and is, and was an incredible historian.
So I jumped ahead a little bit when I asked about driving cab.
Right.
But maybe if you wouldn't mind, so the follow-up to that is just sort of a general overview of what you did from when, again, you decided that getting a PhD was not in your best interests, and then getting the job in the history department.
Okay. What I came to understand, and I don't know that I could put it in a time frame, was that I wasn't a scholar, that I loved research, and I just felt that when I went over and found the ladies' room. I almost didn't come back. I thought, I'll just sit here and soak this up. But I didn't want to explain it to anybody. And sometimes when my historian friends give me their books, I don't want to read them. Because it's like, well, I mean, you have to, it's so tedious to have to explain it all. And what my friend, Ken Bowling, to whom I was married, said to me almost at the time, people matter to you too much. Okay, but that's absolutely true. And I was having lunch with a friend yesterday saying, reminiscing about how much I loved the Carol I had in the Historical Society, and she said, you need a place to sit and read because nobody should be nostalgic for a Carol. I said, well, writing my prelims up there was wonderful. What are you talking about? And she's a retired professor. And partly through this process, I have come to understand how profoundly I love being an historian and the pastor. I have a very powerful church I just started being part of a couple of years ago, and it's just amazingly wonderful. But my pastor also said to me, you're a trained historian. I said, well, I guess I am. It's one of those things where you don't realize how other people see things. It's, you know, I was teasing about everybody's father fought in Spain and everybody's a Brooklyn Dodger fan. Well, no, not exactly. And almost nobody is an historian, again, to exaggerate. But it makes such a difference. And it's so fascinating. And my current sort of passion is race relations. And I was reading a book by a black theologian historian who's got a most incredible beginning of the narrative, which is he describes the Africans walking to the coast and the ships coming and where all the men who were on the ships come from and where all the men walking to the coast come from to bring them to the U.S. or to the New World as we thought of it then, or as we describe it in the aftermath. I don't know what we called it then, or they called it. But black history is amazing. And I was friends with Tom Schick, who was in Afro-American studies and an historian and killed himself, drowned himself in Lake Winground. And that was devastating. Oh, my gosh. And that was just about when I left history to move up the hill. And I was very good friends with Nellie McKay. And sat in on her course, Black Women Writers. And then in the School of Ed, I sat in on a qualitative research methods course with Mary Metz. So I took advantage of the faculty as much as I could. And I was very good friends with Sterling Fishman because he was such a wonderful friend of George's. So you just didn't get to love George if you didn't also love Sterling.
So you come to this moment where you don't want to be a PhD.
Right.
So where do you go?
Then I went and drove a cab. And my decision-making around that was that I wanted some more money because I wanted to buy clothes. I mean, it was very, very clear. And at that point, Ken and I and our son Andrew were all living in a funky little house. Funky is really funky. On the railroad tracks on South Baldwin, and across the railroad tracks was Checker Cab. So I just walked over and got hired. But it was very much, Lord, I can't live on nothing. And I've never, ever liked the idea of being supported by anybody. A couple of times there would be some guy in the cab saying, can't you marry somebody who will support you? I didn't say anything.
So it's there that obviously something happens in your relationship with Checker Cab, and that leads to Union Cab.
We went on strike.
And all that's still happening again in this sort of interim period. So I wonder if you could talk about, you know, why you went on strike.
Oh. Well, that's a good question. I think we were negotiating. I mean, by the time we went on strike, I was a phone person because I never was much good at driving cab. And we were at odds with Ray Veloff, who owned Checker. He went on to own the Madison Inn. Doesn't anymore. And so we met this union guy, I think in our search for how do we organize and sort of how do we have any leverage with Veloff, because we didn't like the way he was running the company. So I remember a bunch of meetings. There's a labor building over on Willie Street, almost to Atwood, and that's where we would meet. I was remembering that. And better working conditions is what I remember, but exactly the specifics of that, I'm not so sure. And the man I married was the dispatcher, and I'm not quite sure sort of at what point that happened in relationship to the establishing union cab. But I think we got union going before he and I got married. I think that's the way it worked, because we were Checker cab out of that little building on South Baldwin, and then when we became union, we were first in a building on East Washington on the south side of the street. And that's where I was filling in the summertime. And I don't think I was married yet at that point. So I think I must have started at Marine Studies out of Checker, and then moved on to the History Department, but kept driving in the summertime, which might have been both with Checker and then with Union. I'm just not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the nights at the Cardinal raising the money for us, our strike fund, and then Press Connection, too.
So you were off campus then, mm-hmm. It sounds like, when you found out about the position of Marine Studies.
Right.
But you said it was because of your connection
with
Dyke. Yes.
Steinhardt, yeah.
Okay.
Because the I think I got this chronology right. His appointment was in Poli Sci and Marine Studies. And the support person for Marine Studies, and it was Bob Rogatsky, too, who was in Marine Studies, when they were still in meteorology and space sciences. So the, IES now is in Science Hall, but some subset of that in terms of the sciences represented is at, I think it's still, no, maybe not, was it 1800 University? I think that's right. But that was later. So I'm not sure what it was that took me to apply for the job in Marine Studies. And I'm not sure how the chronology exactly works. Because we were in the commune, we were living on campus, and then I was living on Baldwin Street. And I think that's right. I mean, I think the collective was before the house on Baldwin Street. And then I went to work for the university. And then I moved over to Dunning Street, but still off campus, very much so.
And then that led us to what we actually started with the first interview, which was you getting the job.
In history. In history. Right. Right.
You know, we may or may not get to your College of Education work experience this time. I know you said you have a very brief answer sort of why you retired when you did. And so I'd like to make sure we get that on this session. So we're going to sort of skip over the College
right.
of Ed stuff
right.
and get to the why retire question.
Well, I had been talking about it with Jeff Hamm. By that time, I was working for Jeff Hamm. There had been some ups and downs. And I kept thinking I was ready to retire, and I wasn't, so I didn't. And he was wonderful about, okay, so don't. And at the same time, I was keenly aware that you don't stay forever. And I was, I did undergraduate advising, and I also did a tremendous amount with the SOAR program, but I was aging out. I mean, many things changed, but 18 to 22 is about the age of undergraduates. So the overlap was receding. And even then, which was 07, maybe? I think that may have been when I retired. Or that, I don't know, because I retired.
I think we have it as 08.
Okay.
So it might have been end of 07.
Okay. It would, no, it was January, so it would have been January of 08 then.
No, 2007. You retired then, and then emeritus status was granted later.
Yeah, right. That took a little while.
So anyway, 2007.
But the Social Security Administration wrote and said, if you're born in 41, then you want to wait 8 months after you turn 65. And that basically hit January. So I was very, very clear and have become ferocious about this since then, that you can't stay because there's only just so many jobs. And because I hadn't, as it happened, I had not yet died, didn't mean that I had any business staying in the job, because by no stretch of the imagination could you say, well, let me put it positively, to work on this campus is one of the finest places you can work in the world because of the care with which most of its history, Wisconsin, the care with which Wisconsin has attended to benefits and to the rights of the employed. Not so much lately, but I just couldn't see it staying. Now, after the fact, it turns out it was an infinitely wiser decision than I realized, because I obviously had some inkling, but when you do the same thing over and over and over again, you lose something. I mean, the difference in what it means to be alive today and what it meant in 07 is staggering. And I say to people all the time, this is the best day of my life. And there's a gorgeous actress who was in Shuck a Lot, and she's just coming out in a new movie with Kristen Stewart, French. Mm. And she said, of course I'm older. I love the present. And that's exactly the way I feel. Mm. But I learned most of that since I retired, which is nothing negative about the university. And I retired just before the School of Ed administration got exiled over to Orchard Street, and then got to move back into that magnificent, I hope you've spent time in that building. Mm-hmm. That's an extraordinary restoration and remodeling.
You know, I think I want to wrap it up here. It's a little shorter than an hour, but
good.
So this concludes the third session with Linda Newman. Linda, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.